Welcome back to another major episode of Robbinsdale Revisited, the podcast where we unpack the boxes in the back of the Historical Society file cabinets, re-examine the vintage photographs, and reconstruct the foundational stories of our community. I'm Crystal Boyd, a member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
And I'm Pete Ritchie. I smile every time I say I'm the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. You know, if you happen to take a drive or walk down Regent Avenue near 42nd today, you're going to find yourself looking at the Parker Village townhouses. It looks like a classic modern community, lots of vinyl siding and some brick facades. But what most people don't realize when they pass this is this exact piece of land was for over a century what locals passionately called the sentimental heart of the entire Robbinsdale School District.
And it's really an incredible piece of land because its history doesn't feature just one school, like Pete was saying. It features an overlapping evolutionary saga of higher education. Also, devastating fires, pioneering public transit, community-funded grammar schools, a sports powerhouse high school, and a massive post-war junior high expansion.
To understand why this specific patch of land became an educational epicenter, we actually have to step all the way back to the late 1880s before Robbinsdale was even an incorporated village. Back then, this was primarily a scene of a farming community under Crystal Lake Township. But a dynamic real estate developer, entrepreneur, and politician named Andrew B. Robbins saw massive potential in these rolling hills and lakes just north of Minneapolis.
And Andrew Robbins really was a visionary, but he hit some pretty big roadblocks pretty early on. His idea was to bring city dwellers out to enjoy hunting, fishing, boating, bathing on the pristine beaches of Twin Lake, so some of those outdoor activities. And he asked the Minneapolis Transit Company to extend a streetcar line out here, but they flat out refused. They didn't think there'd be enough traffic to justify that cost. But Robbins was not a man who took no for an answer. He simply went out and built his own streetcar line and a car barn on Hubbard Avenue, bringing people out to the area in droves.
And it wasn't just tourists coming out. Robbins wanted to build a permanent, deeply rooted community. He knew that to attract families and establish a true cultural identity, he needed world-class institutions. So, in 1889, Andrew Robbins teamed up with two other legendary local mayors and movers and shakers, George Brimball and Alfred Parker, and together these three men donated a massive prime 10-acre tract of land right along a street then known as College Avenue.
Well, today we know it as Regent Avenue, but back then the name College Avenue was literally a statement of intent on that donated land near what would be 4001 Regent Avenue today. They broke ground on a magnificent institution, the Luther Theological Seminary of the Norwegian Lutheran Church.
And there we were. For a minute or two, we were a college town. The grand opening and dedication of this seminary on September 8th, 1889, was easily one of the largest public gatherings the region had ever seen at that point. An estimated audience of over 5,000 people traveled out to attend. The crowd was so massive that the railroad had to schedule three extra trains just to ferry people back and forth from the city.
And it was a really different time because public programs in those days really demanded a rugged audience. So this wasn't a quick ribbon-cutting ceremony. You weren't in and out right away. The people who attended sat on the ground for hours listening to a marathon sequence of heavy academic and religious addresses given in four different languages. Think about that, four different languages: German, Swedish, Norwegian, and English. The state's top dignitaries held court, including Minnesota Governor William Rush Merriam, Senator Knut Nelson, and the legendary University of Minnesota President Cyrus Northrop, alongside theological sermons from the seminary faculty.
It was a phenomenal architectural addition to the landscape. Local resident Mrs. Etta Gates recorded her memories of the campus, describing it as a massive, imposing brick masterpiece. It featured soaring towers, elegant stone trimmings, grand curving driveways, and was beautifully landscaped with manicured shrubs and rows of young trees.
And they did everything on such a grand scale back then. So the seminary was built with some grand ambitions. The blueprints were drawn up with plans to eventually accommodate up to 700 students. The grand basements housed the sprawling cooking and eating facilities, while the president of the seminary occupied luxurious upper-floor apartments that included his own extensive private research library.
And what was truly incredible by modern standards is that lodging and instruction at the Lutheran Theological Seminary were completely free to students. The only thing they had to pay for was their weekly board, which ran a grand total of about $1.50 to $2 a week. Despite its 700 student capacity, the actual enrollment hovered around 45 young men for this institution's brief existence.
That's a bit of a gap, but and it was brief because disaster struck on the bitterly cold morning of January 11th, 1895. In the dead of winter, a ferocious fire broke out inside the structure. The local volunteer crews stood little chance against the combination of freezing temperatures and roaring flames, and in less than 1 hour, the entire magnificent brick structure was completely destroyed.
Yeah, and it really was a devastating loss for our little community. And the church ultimately decided not to rebuild on College Avenue. Instead, they packed up the institution and relocated it over on Como Avenue in St. Paul, where it evolved into the Luther Seminary we know today. But while Robbinsdale lost its bid to become a major college town, the 10-acre plot on Regent Avenue was far from done. The other thing that was great about having those students here in town is during the summer, they helped Andrew B. Robbins build his little streetcar railway from Robbinsdale down to Minneapolis. And so he had this great college labor there. All these young men were laying track with him for that little streetcar line.
Well, they were laying the track, and the seminary was training those young pastors. But at the same time, the local farming communities were dealing with an explosion of children who needed a standard grammar school education. In 1890, the full 3 years before Robbinsdale officially broke away from the township to become an independent village, the local citizens decided it was time to build a permanent grade school.
The townspeople were incredibly optimistic. They looked at the blueprints and genuinely believed that this new building would be large enough to serve the needs of the community indefinitely and for all time. The local school board, consisting of Chairman L.A. Taylor, Clerk H.R. Stillman, and Treasurer Jarius Russ, officially authorized the raising of a massive sum of $10,000 in taxes. To put that in perspective, $10,000 was a small fortune for a farming community in 1890, but the taxpayers willingly paid it because they wanted the absolute best for their kids.
And that is exactly what they got. District 24 secured what was widely recognized in Hennepin County as one of the absolute finest, most modern school buildings in the entire state of Minnesota. They named it the Parker School, which is in honor of Alfred Parker, who was not only one of the original land donors, but also a lifelong pioneer, a Mexican War veteran, a California Gold Rush 49er, and a fierce advocate for local education.
The Parker School officially opened its doors for the public inspection on October 3rd, 1890, to an incredible, proud crowd of local families. Regular classes commenced on October 8th. At the start, the faculty consisted of just four teachers overseeing roughly 40 pupils, meaning each room had to pull double duty, housing two district grade levels together.
And community pride around the Parker School was sky high. By June 5th, 1891, the town held a massive fundraising social at the town hall, specifically to purchase a grand American flag for the schoolhouse. And just a week later, a beautiful flag-raising ceremony took place on the school grounds, which virtually every parent in the district turned out to celebrate.
You know, I think it's important to mention here that the Luther Seminary and the Parker School, for at least a few years, stood together. So if you were looking down Regent Avenue, or College Avenue, it was called then, you would see the tower of the Luther Seminary, which is a little reminiscent, I think, of Duluth Central High School, the Minneapolis City Hall. It wasn't quite that grand, but that was the look that it had. I guess it's Romanesque. And then the next thing you would see would be the bell tower for the Parker School. Structurally, the Parker School is a work of art. The building featured a heavy stone basement, masterfully laid brick walls, and an elegant stone trim. E.K. Jacks, writing in his 1891 Township History of Hennepin County, noted that the entire school was exclusively finished in solid oak. It featured spacious hallways, four massive main classrooms, dedicated cloakrooms, administrative offices, and specialized recitation rooms. It was outfitted with a state-of-the-art steam heating system and a furnace room in the basement alongside a dedicated indoor gymnasium area.
It's kind of an interesting time in history when the indoors is starting to have its own environment and aesthetic compared to the outdoors. So outside the school walls, the landscape was still wild and rustic, you know, still a little bit remote out here. Right behind the Parker School building, there was a natural pond. And in the spring, when the heavy Minnesota snow melted, this pond would become incredibly deep and wide. And it became a favorite, even though dangerous, playground for local kids. And a student from that era, Robert W. Girard, who later grew up to become a prominent pastor out in Polar, Wisconsin, wrote in his memoirs about the sobering day a local boy tragically drowned in that very pond.
Yikes. Yeah. You know, that field was still flooding when I was a kid and there was a junior high there. Despite the country dangers, school life inside the oak-finished walls was vibrant, structured, and strictly monitored. In 1904, the Minneapolis Journal launched a revolutionary weekend supplement called the Junior Journal. The editors reached out to schools all across the Twin Cities metro, requesting that the students submit brief, honest sketches of their daily lives and these unique adventures and personal reflections. Well, we still have them today.
And the children of the Parker School took up their pens and submitted some of the absolute best, most vivid snapshots of turn-of-the-century childhood that you could find anywhere.
Let's tune our dials back to the early 1900s and listen to the real stories of the Parker School student body. Our first letter comes from 7th grader Irene Bowles, who records a terrifying long afternoon when she got completely stranded in downtown Minneapolis because of a minor public transit update.
Pretty near dinner time. One day in June, in the summer of 1902, after having been called on an errand to the Globe Building in Minneapolis, I walked with Mother to the corner of 1st Avenue South and 5th Street, where she left me to take the 20th Avenue car for home. She was going shopping in another part of the city. It was about 11 o'clock, and Mama gave me permission to go a block from there and get some popcorn. So the last she saw of me, I had started after it. When about 3 hours later she arrived at home, I had not been seen or heard from. Together, Father and Mother started for the city in search of me. After having called at the police station and at the Globe Building in hope of finding me, Mother decided to go back to the place where she had left me. When a block away, she recognized me twirling first on one foot and then the other, gazing steadily at every passing car. During all this time, which had been from 11 till 5 o'clock, I had stood on the corner, watching eagerly for my car. I was beginning to feel that it must be pretty near dinner time. I did not get home because the name on the car had been changed from 20th Avenue North and 1st Avenue South to 20th Avenue North and Harriet. And every time I inquired of anyone passing, I was told that the car would come in a few minutes. I never before or since knew of such long minutes. Need I say I did justice to my 7 o'clock dinner? Irene Bullis, 7th grade, Parker School. Box 36, Robbinsdale, Minnesota. I mean, you have to love the mental image of poor Irene just spinning on one foot for 6 hours straight, staring down the streetcars, entirely determined not to board the wrong one.
It really shows how massive the transition to electric streetcars was back then. Now, while the kids were adventurous outside and inside the school, they lived under a very strict regime. In fact, a young man named Theodore Christensen served as a principal at the Parker School during this exact era. He was a staunch Republican who later went on to serve three highly successful terms as the governor of Minnesota from 1925 to 1931. But according to old-time local school lore, long before he governed the state, Principal Christensen was widely known for using stiff rubber hoses to maintain absolute discipline among the unruly youngsters.
Boy, talk about different times. I mean, I guess a rubber hose would keep you focused on your studies. Our second letter comes from a fifth grader named Lawrence Bub Nassett. Lawrence was actually the son of Robbinsdale's very first retail merchant, and he gives us a masterclass in the absolute psychological dread of getting your name put on the teacher's disciplinary slip.
You know, that feels like something I've had experience with. I'll give this one a try. A name on a slip. One day, I brought a storybook to school because a friend of mine wanted to see the pictures. In school hours, I took the book out of my desk and began to read in it. When I was very much interested, the teacher passed and took the book away from me. She put my name on a slip and said, "I want to see you after school." I learned all my lessons the rest of the day. I was very much frightened, as I thought she would punish me severely. It was soon 4 o'clock, and the pupils began to pass out of the schoolhouse. When they were all out of the room, she called me up to her desk and asked me why I brought the book to school. I could not answer. She told me not to bring any more storybooks to school. I promised I would not. She then excused me, and I went home happy and said to myself, "I'm going to be a good boy tomorrow." That was a danger signal to me. Lawrence Nassett, fifth grade, Parker School, Robbinsdale, Minnesota. Lawrence learned his lesson without the rubber hose, luckily. Our third letter is from eighth grader Flossie Patch. Flossie was an incredibly expressive writer, but she seemed to be an absolute magnet for chaos and minor medical mishaps. Here is her account of a summer day that went completely off the rails.
A smart hornet that. One morning, Mama told me that my uncle had come after me to go and visit my cousin, but finding me still in bed, had gone away without me. I had not seen this cousin all summer, as she lived several miles away, so I was sorely disappointed when I found this chance had slipped by. After feeding the little chickens and doing a few other chores, I took my favorite storybook and sat down under an apple tree and tried not to think of my disappointment. I had not been there long when there was a sting on my shoulder and a big ugly hornet buzzed away as though he had done something smart. And indeed he had, for oh, how my shoulder did smart. I hurried into the house, and after Mama had put some soda on it, I felt much better. She said when the bee stung me, I screamed as though almost anything from a snake to a grizzly bear was after me. I lay down on the lounge and soon went to sleep, forgetting all my troubles, but my mischievous brother happened in. I awoke with a sneeze, for he had sprinkled some pepper about my nose. Then I thought I would do something to displease him, so I took his fishing rod and went to the pond to fish. In trying to bait the hook, I stuck it into my finger, then I dropped the pole into the water, and in trying to recover it, fell in myself. I began to scream, for I thought I should drown. I climbed out all right and went home, crying at the top of my voice. When Mother saw me, dripping wet, she forbade my going outdoors again that day, for every time I went out, I came back in crying. Flossie Patch, 8th grade, Parker School, Robbinsdale, Minnesota. Well, you have to almost applaud her brother's commitment to pure mischief with that pepper bomb while she was resting.
Absolutely classic sibling behavior. Now, our next entry comes from 8th grader Ruth Burdick. Ruth gives a deeply touching look at how a long, lovely summer trip away from home completely turned around by an unexpected four-legged gift from her uncle. Here, do you want to be Ruth?
I can be Ruth.
Okay.
A patient beast, Dixie. I was visiting at my uncle's ranch out west and felt very homesick. Mama would arrive for a week, and there was nothing for my amusement as far as I could see, as my uncle had no children. Aunt tried to amuse me, but she was not used to children and did not succeed very well. One night, noticing that I did not get over my homesickness, my uncle said that he would see if he could find something I would like. He was going to market the next day, and expectation cheered me. At night, when he came home, great was my surprise to see a small, shaggy burrow in the yard, and my uncle told me he was for me to play with. I ran to him, put my arms around him, and hugged him. I was overjoyed. The little animal liked, or at least appeared to like me, too, and seemed very friendly and tolerant of the ardent caresses that I showered upon him. We were then and there pronounced friends, and we were constant companions for the rest of my visit. Time passed only too quickly for me. When I was about to go away, I wanted to take Dixie with me, but to my bitter disappointment, I could not. We had spent so many happy hours together, sometimes frolicking about, but more often the sturdy little animal bearing me on his back as he trudged about for my pleasure. And so my short visit passed. I have never heard from him since, but I think that when he was older, he proved very useful to my uncle. Ruth Burdick, 8th grade, Parker School, Robbinsdale, Minnesota.
There's truly nothing like a shaggy burrow to snap a kid right out of an intense case of homesickness. Moving from ranch life back to the neighborhoods of Robbinsdale, our next story comes from fifth grader Florence Mosier. Florence captures the beautiful, gentle community tradition that was highly popular at the turn of the century, but unfortunately has faded away today, hanging custom May baskets to welcome a brand new neighbor.
Remembering the new girl. I expect to have a good time this May Day, but not any better than I had last year. I was staying with my cousin, and we had made many May baskets. We were going to hang one at the home of a little girl who lived a quarter of a mile from our home. She was a stranger, as the family had moved there about a week before. None of the children had been to visit her, so we decided to go that night. We made a heart-shaped May basket and covered it with blue tissue paper. We put some cream candy in the bottom, and then put some violets and mayflowers in. We tied them with white ribbon and also tied some on the handle. So at dusk, we started. We hung the basket on the front door, and when Mabel opened the door and saw the basket with her own name on, she was very much surprised. After she found us, we went into the house and had a good time. She told us she thought at first none of the girls would call on her, but she was mistaken. Florence Mosier, fifth grade, Parker School, Robbinsdale, Minnesota.
What a wonderful snapshot of old school hospitality. To close out our look at the Journal Junior Archives, we have a second submission from eighth grader Flossie Patch. I wonder if Flossie and Florence were pals. It seems she completely dried off from her fall into the school pond because she wrote a surprisingly poetic, deeply earnest defense of why a simple harvest pumpkin is the most beautiful plant in the world.
A big, beautiful pumpkin. There are a great many different kinds of trees and plants, and I believe each and every person has a favorite. For my part, I think there is nothing more beautiful than a large yellow pumpkin. The seeds, usually planted in cornfields, sprout, grow up, and become thrifty vines, and upon these grow large yellow flowers. These flowers are shaped something like petunia blossoms, but are many times larger. Soon there appears, where the corolla joins the stem, a little green pumpkin about as large as a marble. This pumpkin grows till it becomes about as large as a water pail, and soon, under the October sun, turns a golden yellow. What is more beautiful than a field of corn shocked up, and among the shocks, great yellow pumpkins scattered here and there? And what tastes better than a pumpkin pie? I am sure there is nothing. All the small boys, and some larger ones, are very fond of making jack-o'-lanterns. Could you make a jack-o'-lantern without a pumpkin? There are many trees and plants in all parts of the world, but as far as I've seen a pumpkin, perfect in shape and golden in color, is as beautiful as any. Flossie Patch, 8th grade, Parker School, Robbinsdale, Minnesota. Man, I mean, that is a pretty compelling case for a pumpkin. You can kind of smell the autumn air and the pumpkin pies baking and those old wood-burning stoves just listening to her.
Absolutely. But as the quiet, pumpkin-filled autumns moved along, the village of Robbinsdale began to experience an unprecedented population boom. Remember how the original 1890 school board thought the Parker School was going to be big enough for all time? Well, in 1913, the little building was completely overwhelmed. The student body had skyrocketed past 200 children.
Well, that meant they had to act pretty fast. They officially issued $14,000 in bonds to fund a major expansion, building four large additional classrooms directly onto the front face of the original structure. To mark this new era, they officially dropped the name Parker School and rebranded the facility as the Robbinsdale Public School.
And so 1913 was also a historic year for the community because a local leader named Carrie Swift stepped up and organized Robbinsdale's very first parent-teacher association. And back in those early days, the PTA wasn't just organizing book fairs or planning holiday parties. It was a literal community lifeline. The early PTA members worked tirelessly to provide hot lunches, fresh milk, and warm winter clothing for local children who otherwise would have completely gone without. They would also provide shoes. A lot of times these kids would show up to school with no shoes on their feet. And I look at pictures of the old Parker School student body. And there's all these, you know, if you look down the front row, only about half of them are wearing shoes.
Well, as the calendar flipped into the 1920s, the village exploded into a full-on boom town. This was the Roaring Twenties, and Robbinsdale was right at the center of a cultural phenomenon. A local military veteran named Wilford Hamilton Fawcett, or more popularly known as Captain Billy, started a tiny humor magazine right here in town called Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. It was full of jokes, slang, and cultural quips aimed at soldiers and sailors. And it didn't stay a tiny magazine long. It became an absolute runaway national sensation, launching a massive publishing empire that eventually brought us other magazines like True Confessions, Modern Mechanics, and the iconic Captain Marvel comic books.
Yeah, and I'm sure some kids over there at the Robbinsdale Public School, you know, had Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, and they were memorizing jokes out of Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. They probably stuck it under their school books and, you know, keeked it out every once in a while when nobody was looking. Between the roaring publishing business, the installation of the new public water system, and gas stoves replacing old ironwood stoves, people were moving to Robbinsdale in droves. By the mid-1920s, the population swelled to past 5,000 residents, a staggering increase from the 1,369 residents in 1920. To create a unified system across neighboring villages of Crystal, Golden Valley, and Robbinsdale, the city underwent a massive street renaming project. And that's when the historic College Avenue officially became Regent Avenue.
And that school on Regent Avenue just couldn't expand fast enough to keep up with the baby boom of the 1920s. So first they built a second major brick addition extending to the south. Then a few years later, they had to construct even more classrooms, plus some administrative offices and a brand new main auditorium onto the north and west sides of the building. When the bricklayers couldn't move fast enough, the district brought in a standalone wooden building known as the South Town Portable to handle the daily student overflow.
Yeah, and I'm told it really was portable and that at one point it sat where Lee School later sat and where Lee Square Cooperative is now, but then it would move back and forth between Regent and Lee Avenue, which seems like quite an undertaking. For decades, it had been the ultimate dream of Robbinsdale citizens to have a dedicated standalone high school in their own village so their teenagers wouldn't have to commute to Minneapolis. But the finances and conditions just never seemed right until the height of the Great Depression. In 1935, the federal government, under the Progressive Public Works Administration, or PWA program, offered to step in. The PWA added a massive federal grant of $122,000, and they eventually increased that to $135,000 to match the $124,000 that local Robbinsdale taxpayers proudly voted to fund.
So all of that together, the total cost of the project reached a staggering $300,000. To clear enough physical space on the property to build it, the town actually had to jack up and physically move three existing houses and an entire store building a full block away. Ground was officially broken in March 1936, and construction teams worked at lightning speed. The brand new high school building was erected a mere 30 feet away from the existing Parker School building.
Classes officially commenced on September 11, 1936, and the building was formally dedicated with incredibly impressive town-wide ceremonies on May 19, 1937. The school board successfully guided this massive historical project to completion, and at that time, the school board included Dr. Henry E. Hartig as chairman, Mrs. Edith Robbins Daniel as clerk, who, by the way, was Andrew Robbins' eldest daughter and served a phenomenal 25 years on the school board, alongside A.E. Prince as treasurer, Dr. E.P. Hosterman, William Cavanaugh, and Dr. R.C. Rawson. And of course, when we hear those names, we think of Cavanaugh Elementary School. We think of Hosterman Junior High. These guys went on to spend a lot of time with the school district.
And we actually have some incredible vintage photographs in the historical collection that show the school board gathered together, and they're watching intently as Chairman Henry Hartig carefully seals a historic time capsule directly into the brick wall of the brand new school.
So the completed facility actually looked a lot like Riverdale High School from the Archies. The superintendent at the time was Edwin J. Cooper, who went on to have a legendary, highly distinguished career leading our public schools. He reported that the new building was a massive hit. It was so popular and its modern amenities were so famous that Cooper had to repeatedly turn down requests from Minneapolis parents who were desperate to transfer their kids into the Robbinsdale system.
Side note, was that uniform from Cooper?
Yeah.
Can I tell about my favorite thing that I found in the collection?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. I just want to hop in because Edwin J. Cooper was the superintendent of schools, but he had also served in the Army. And here at the Robbinsdale Historical Society, we have his Army uniform, And it's tiny. Like, he was a little guy. I don't think I could fit into it. He was a little bit on the smaller side. But when we were doing the inventory, I flipped up one of the cuffs on the top to sew a number on the inside. And when I flipped it up, I found on each side a patch with a dragon. And this is not army issued. These are unique that he had sewn in there, because when men would serve in the army overseas, they would go to the bar and roll up their sleeves and show off their unique patches, like their dragon patches, and show everybody that they were individuals and they were kind of cool. And that's one of my favorite things I found in the collection.
Oh, how about that? So Cooper was in the army, but they didn't have an Air Force at the time, but he was in the Army Air Corps. So he was a flyer. He showed up in France maybe a week or two before the war ended. And so the story was always that the Germans were so afraid of E.J. Cooper that they just surrendered when he got to France.
Maybe he showed them his dragon patches.
I'm sure he did.
Well, so this building, you know, it was gorgeous. It was a fully fireproof brick structure packed with cutting-edge internal devices. It featured acoustic, soundproofed corridors outfitted with sleek, recessed clothes lockers. There were specialty purpose rooms, advanced technical and machine shops, and a highly sophisticated two-way radio and public address system. This PA system allowed the principal to listen in on what was happening in any classroom in the building directly from his main desk and talk back and forth with the teacher in real time. Pete, what kind of conversations do you think he heard listening in?
I don't know. I just imagine him sort of spying, wondering, I wonder how they're doing. And I'm just going to check in and have a listen. The brand new high school completely shifted the regional balance, instantly relieving an overcrowded Minneapolis high school of about 350 pupils, 250 from right here in Robbinsdale and another 100 from nearby surrounding communities. Together, the original grade school and the new high school formed a massive, cutting-edge $500,000 combined school plant that could easily accommodate 1,500 to 1,600 students.
So with that, almost overnight, Robbinsdale High School became an absolute sports powerhouse in the state. In the 1940s, the school produced one of its very first true national sports icons, a young man named Vern Gagne. Gagne was a natural elite athlete who completely dominated in football, baseball, boxing, and wrestling. He won a spectacular string of consecutive district, regional, and state championships in high school wrestling, while simultaneously being named to the coveted all-state football team.
Of course, our local listeners know that Vern Gagne didn't stop there. He went on to become an international professional wrestling icon, a master promoter, and a historic 16-time American Wrestling Association World Heavyweight Champion, putting Robbinsdale athletics firmly on the national map.
But right here, as the school was enjoying its athletic glory, the conclusion of World War II triggered the single greatest population disruption the city had ever seen, the post-war baby boom. Suddenly, houses, shopping centers, and drive-ins were appearing overnight within the city's 3 square miles. Between the 1940s and 1950s, Robbinsdale added over 10,000 new citizens.
And to cope with the sheer tidal wave of new children, the newly formed District 281 had to embark on a historic building campaign, constructing a staggering 18 brand new elementary schools over the next 28 years, alongside multiple junior and senior high schools. It kicked off the fall of 1948 with the grand opening of Lee Elementary School, and that was quickly followed by the massive Adair Elementary School in 1952, which was built right on the site of the old Galk truck farm.
The opening of Lee and Adair finally allowed the aging school buildings on Regent Avenue to stop housing primary school students. The campus was converted to exclusively house grades 7 through 12. But the population pressures kept rising. By 1956, the district was forced to build a brand new, sprawling Robbinsdale Senior High School over at Toledo and 37th Avenues.
When the high schoolers packed up and moved to Toledo Avenue, the longtime principal, Milo Milkey, who served a phenomenal 39 years with our schools before retiring in 1968, moved with them. With the high school students gone, the historic Regent Avenue campus officially transitioned into the Robbinsdale Junior High School. A dedicated educator named Mark T. Woodward took over as principal, serving the junior high families faithfully until his retirement in 1974.
The junior high era brought some incredibly memorable upgrades to the site, In 1965, the residents of the seven communities making up District 281 voted to pass a massive $600,000 bond to construct brand new pool buildings at Sandburg and Robbinsdale Junior High. In the spring of 1967, the Regent Avenue pool officially opened for both school and widespread community use.
I never heard it called the Regent Avenue pool, but that's where I went to swimming lessons. Those pools were highly advanced for the late 1960s. The main tank measured 75 feet long by 42 feet wide, with a specialized separate diving area measuring 30 feet by 16 feet. The water depth ranged from a shallow 3 feet up to 5 feet in the main swimming pool, dropping to a deep 9 feet in the diving well. Each pool held a whopping 128,000 gallons of water. And in a major upgrade for pool maintenance and comfort, the district chose to use bromine as a disinfectant instead of the traditional chlorine because it was vastly less irritating to the students' eyes.
Now, if you talk to any of the alumni from back then who attended Robbinsdale Junior High in the late 1960s or 1970s, they instantly remind you of one of the most infamous aspects of gym class back then. Pete, would you like to tell us more?
Well, there was mandatory nude swimming for boys in gym class. And this memory always comes up when you talk about junior high swim classes. It certainly was a different era.
Well, the girls got to wear suits, right? But the boys did not.
Right. And who knows why? I'm just trying to imagine, you know, the gym teacher is fully clothed and, you know, 20, 30 naked boys jump into the pool and start swimming around. And it wasn't like they thought this was normal. The kids all thought, why? Why are we swimming naked in the pool? And the gym teacher is marching back and forth and having them do laps or teaching them how to swim. Yeah, what a strange thing. I mean, just in case you weren't self-conscious enough in junior high, your gym teacher tells you guys to all strip and jump into the pool. But that's how it was. And it wasn't just in Robbinsdale. It was that way throughout the Midwest. I've seen newspaper articles from Duluth where they finally decided to let the boys wear swimsuits like in 1975. But yeah, they didn't do that to the girls. It certainly was a different era. By 1971, the district realized that the sprawling piecemeal complex on Regent Avenue was facing some serious structural issues. The poor circulation of thousands of students moving through decades of mismatched additions was causing massive daily log jams, and various academic departments were completely scattered across opposite ends of the campus.
They had some ideas to fix this, so the district authorized a major $3.5 million modernization project. They hired the highly recognized Minneapolis architecture firm of Bissell, Belair, and Green, who had actually served as the primary architects for District 281 schools all the way back to 1937. So they had some ideas to fix this. The district authorized a massive $3.5 million modernization project. They hired the highly recognized Minneapolis architecture firm of Bissell, Belair, and Green, who had actually served as the primary architects for District 281 schools all the way back to 1937. In November 1971, the Robbinsdale High School newspaper, The Robin, sent out an intrepid student reporter named Julie Benson to interview the firm's president, Mr. Gene Green, to get the scoop on what was happening on the campus.
Architect Gene Green told the Robin reporter that the school was undergoing a complete rejuvenation. The sweeping, ultra-modern remodel completely transformed the interior layout. They leveled the floor of the historic old auditorium to install two full-size state-of-the-art gymnasiums. They knocked out walls to create an innovative inner student court and mall area, completely enlarged and remodeled the student cafeteria, establishing a massive modern library, and built custom departmental learning resource centers and high-tech teaching labs.
But to make physical room for this massive 35-classroom modernization wing, a heartbreaking sacrifice had to be made. The original, historic 1890 Parker School building, the oldest standing school structure in the entire city, was officially slated for demolition. Over the winter of 1913, its iconic front facade had been preserved through expansions, but by 1972, the old oak-finished schoolhouse was completely torn down and reduced to rubble.
It was a deeply bittersweet transition, but the modernized Robbinsdale Junior High pushed forward. Unbelievably, though, just 8 short years after the massive $3.5 million remodel was completed, the district faced a completely unforeseen crisis, declining enrollment. I don't understand how that could be unforeseen. You had the baby boom there through. The post-war baby boom had officially crested and the student population was dropping fast. The school board realized that they had to close one of the district's junior highs to balance the budget.
When the board targeted Robbinsdale Junior High for closure in 1979, the local community was absolutely heartbroken and furious. This site was the literal sentimental heart of the entire town. A passionate local alumnus named Joy Johnson Robb, who had the incredible distinction of attending school on that exact Regent Avenue site for her entire education, from kindergarten all the way through her 12th grade graduation, stepped up to lead a fierce grassroots public battle against the school board to save the school.
Yeah, Joy and local families put up an incredible fight, but the declining numbers were just undeniable. In 1979, the doors of Robbinsdale Junior High were officially locked to appease the angry residents and prevent an outright revolt. The school explicitly promised that the high school itself would remain open, a promise that, as local history buffs know, only lasted a few more years before closures hit the senior high levels as well, splitting students between Armstrong and Cooper.
After the junior high closed in 1979, those beautiful newly remodeled hallways sat completely empty and lonely for 5 long years. But in 1984, the building received a fascinating, highly experimental second life. The district chose the Regent Avenue facility to house its brand new, cutting-edge technology learning campus, popularly known as the TLC program.
Tender Loving Care. The TLC program brought 300 full-time students back into the building alongside specialized community education programs that were transferred over from Sunny Hollow in New Hope and the Fair Community Education Center in Crystal. Part of the sprawling facility was also converted into the bustling Robbinsdale Community Center, bringing life, music, and meetings back into the historic block.
Eventually, though, the wheels of progress turned again. District 281 relocated the specialized technology learning campus to a different facility, and the community center officially closed its doors. The building sat quiet until 2005, when the entire historic complex, including the original 1936 high school structures, was completely demolished, clearing the 10-acre tract once and for all to make way for the Parker Village townhouses.
Yep, good old Vinyl Village. But if you visit the neighborhood today, you'll find the memory of what happened there has been beautifully and permanently preserved. Earl R. Johnson, a proud member of the Robbinsdale High School class of 1951 and former president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, worked alongside Robbinsdale officials to design, fund, and construct a permanent memorial monument right at the intersection of Regent and 42nd.
The monument features a grand pedestal topped with historical plaques dedicated to the two great institutions that stood on that ground: the Parker School, later Robbinsdale Elementary, which stood from 1890 to 1972, and Robbinsdale High School, which stood from 1936 to 2004. And in a beautiful poetic touch, the physical pedestal of that monument was hand-built using actual salvaged face bricks saved from the demolition of the original 1936 high school building.
Aww. It's a remarkable testament to the community. Over a century of history, thousands of lives, children's adventures, championship wrestling runs, pioneering education, all anchored on a single stretch of road. The buildings might be gone, but through records, photographs, and the voices of those kids, the spirit of Regent Avenue schools remains completely unforgettable.
And we want to give a massive thank you to historians like Helen Blodgett, author of Robbinsdale Then and Now, and the archive team at the Robbinsdale Historical Society, whose dedication to preserving these file cabinets makes this show possible. Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
But right here, as the school was enjoying its athletic glory, the conclusion of World War II triggered the single greatest sneeze in the history of Robin's Hill.
Sir Ben.